Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller with the first part of a special series that takes us on a trip to Fort Yukon. Like proper tourists, the first thing we did was pay a call at the local museum. There is a museum in Fort Yukon. It's a large log building that sits inside a replica of a stockade which represents the original fort. When I walked in the gates, it was late October, well past the tourist season, but there to greet me was Ginny Alexander. She says her only qualification to run a museum is that she'd visited one once. But as you'll hear, when it comes to the art and history of Fort Yukon, she knows her stuff and is a very gracious tour guide.
Our main goal in the museum is to preserve the culture and the history of the Yukon Flats area, particularly of the Gwich'in. And that's what we try to do through the collection of and preservation of artifacts, tapes, maps, archival materials. Anything that has to do with Yukon Flats history or culture is what we collect.
So, where do you get the things?
Almost everything in here that you see is either on loan to us or was given to us. The only exception is the beadwork. Now, the women are used to selling beadwork, so that's how we had to spend our $5,000. If we saw something else that we wanted to buy, they'd just give it to us rather than sell it to us because they weren't used to selling other things, you know, like if we wanted a bone scraper, for example, they'd say, oh, you can just have it, you know. And I said, well, we'll pay, you know, we'll be glad to pay you for it. And they said, no, you know. But the beadwork is what we spent most of our money on. And we were fortunate because we were able to contact a woman who'd been here about 30 years ago and who had purchased a lot of beadwork before, you know, older beadwork at that time. So that's where we got quite a bit of our older things. And
Fort Yukon seems to be famous for its beadwork. Is it a particular style, or why is beadwork so so famous in this area, or so important?
Well, in the first place, the Fort Yukon women still do a lot of beadwork. It's available. You can get it here. And in the second place, they not only do it, but they do such a beautiful job on it. The girls learn how to do, and the boys too, learn how to do beadwork starting about in the second grade. And they continue learning and improving their skills, so that by the time they're young adults, they've had, you know, maybe 10 years of experience behind them, and they're very, very good at it. Also, a lot of the people here have an eye for color and for design, and they incorporate this in their beadwork. The beadwork is the way they express themselves artistically. This is a Ginny Alexander theory on why beadwork is popular in the Yukon Flats area, and I think that originally the reason was that the Gwich'in are nomadic, were nomadic people, and they were traveling around all the time. And as a result, their artwork had to be meet three standards. First, it had to be lightweight. So you don't see any totem poles up here because you can't exactly pack a totem pole around with you. And then it had to be useful or for personal adornment because you don't carry around something you're not going to use. And then it had to be portable. So although they knew how to make ceramic pots and whatnot, they didn't do it very often because they were too fragile and would break too easily. But beadwork met all three standards and gave them an outlet for expressing their, sense of the artistic. And I think that has a lot to do with why beadwork is popular. Originally, too, beads were extremely expensive and were worn to show that you were wealthy, you know, that it was a social status. In fact, it's another reason, another Ginny Alexander theory is before the coming of the white man, the Gwich'in used to decorate their clothing with porcupine quills. And they do beautiful porcupine quill work. I don't know if you've ever seen an example, but it's very, very nice. And today, you can't hardly get anyone to do porcupine quill work for you, and no matter how much you offer them. And I think it's a little bit harder to do quill work, but I think the main reason is the fact that quill work was worn by poor people, and so it's a sociological thing rather than the fact that they can't or don't want to. It's just that it's, I think it's the social influence that plays a large part on that.
Because it's more rare, they could certainly sell it for more if one were to do porcupine quill work, I think.
Oh, yes, yes. You could, you know, you can say, well, we'll give you $300 for a pair of slippers with porcupine quill work, whereas they sell beadwork slippers for maybe $65, and it's still no, they still won't do it.
Can you tell by looking at beadwork that it came from Fort Yukon?
Well, not always, but generally you can. In fact, if you've worked with beadwork for any length of time, you get so that you can usually pretty much identify whose beadwork it is, because each person has their own style. They have their own patterns that they use. Some, they have their own colors. You can tell an awful lot about a person by the colors that they choose and the designs that they use and like this.
One thing I've been noticing looking at the older things, we're at a display of clothing that I think you said the bilingual kids put up. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I can see the difference not only because it's older looking and kind of dusty, but the style of the older beadwork. There's some older mittens and a belt, and the things that are obviously newer. Is that just an evolution of style that was dropped and not picked up?
Or? Well, if you'd like, I could just give you a little bit of background on some of this beadwork here.
Okay.
This piece up here is a baby strap, and this was done on a loom, and it was made in Old Crow, Canada. But the two end pieces, you can see, were done in the way they do beadwork now. They used goose bones here for decoration, and these pink things are what the government used to tag ducks and geese with, and you can see how they've used it as in decoration.
So okay, we have to describe this a little better. What we have is a, is it about a 4-inch wide belt, solidly beaded with woven, and then the what individual bead, and the goose bone is just like a long cylinder, and then the pink thing is like a plastic band that's holding a tassel together. Is it plastic?
Yeah, it is plastic, but it's the people of the Gwich'in are ingenious at using whatever is available, and I think it looks neat. I really like it, but anyway, in the old days, you can, one way of telling how an older piece of beadwork is, you'll see that the design is actually a porcupine quill design. It's a geometrical type of a design. And that's what, this is a geometrical design. They always put it on pointed toed slippers, but never on rounded toed. And this means that she was copying an old design. And another way to tell, if you look at that other beaded belt up there on the, it's a floral design on black velvet. And this is one of the older pieces. And the way beadwork really got started in this area was the French nuns taught the Canadian Indians how to sew, and those designs worked their way west, and I think that the people, now I'm not positive on this, but I kind of think that the people from Fort Yukon learned from the people of Old Crow, whom were closely related to, how to do beadwork, and it's so all of the older pieces of beadwork have this very strong French design. The leaves are French, they're not indigenous to this area at all. There's a lot of things that are standard on the old beadwork. There's always a double line on the stem. And then you see those two little beads on either side of the stem all over on the stem?
Mm-hmm. That's like little spines, sort of.
Yeah, right. They like look like thorns, kind of. And that's always on older pieces of beadwork. The four little beads, groups of four little beads all along the edge on old pieces of beadwork. Those were called, I think those were called mouse tracks. And always, it's four beads. And that's almost always on pieces of old beadwork. Another way to tell an old piece of beadwork, of course, is the size of the beads. The older the beadwork, the smaller the beads. And another thing is that they're more irregular. The older beads are more irregular. You have some that are kind of big and some that are kind of small. Some that are so tiny you can't hardly even see them. Another thing you see quite often in old beadwork, there isn't any on this particular example, but quite frequently it shows up on an older piece, is the metal beads. Women don't use much in the way of metal beads anymore, but in the old days they did use them, and you'll see that they're rusted together and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But the open floral design was done either on black velvet, like in this case, or on directly on moose hide or caribou skin, and it was left open. Then in the 1930s, women started getting women's magazines up here in Fort Yukon, and you know how they had the little hearts and the stars and all this kind of thing in the magazines at that time? The women saw these magazines and incorporated some of those things into their designs. So you'll quite often see pieces from around the 1930s that have the heart designs in them. You don't see that prior to 1930. And but they still also use some of the old style. That three-cornered type of flower there, you see the blue?
Like a clover.
Right. That is typical of the older style. Also, the little round thing, it's just a round, like a round dot, and those were quite often done on older beadwork. So this person who made this probably made it around 1930, and she was brought up by an older woman, and her beadwork reflects this. Then in the 1950s, when we had a hospital here, we had quite a few white nurses, and the Sears Roebuck Company very kindly sent up catalogs. One of the things that the nurses saw in the catalogs were those patent leather slippers with the straps on them. You know, the
like Mary Jane's.
Yes. And anyway, so they saw these in the catalog and asked some of the ladies here to make moose hide slippers like this. And that's when this style became popular. And you'll see quite a few, there's quite a few pairs of that floating around. And that's from around the 1950s. And then I don't know exactly when it started, but prior to 1960, the women started sewing on white felt. And because moose hide was becoming more and more rare and more expensive. And so they started sewing on white felt, and they put the felt down, then they put a brown paper sack for backing on it that holds the felt in shape so it doesn't stretch out of shape. And it gives it a little extra support. And then they sew their design on, but you no longer see the open design that you saw in the early beadwork, because they had to fill in all the background in order to cover up all the felt, because the felt attracts dirt. So that's why you see the solid designs, and you see that the designs get more and more simple. The more recent the beadwork, generally speaking, the more simple is the design. They have simplified the designs to the point where it's just very, very basic flowers. And they almost always do flowers. Once in a while, they'll do a bird or an animal, but that's not too common. Another thing that's you'll sometimes see on beadwork, although we don't have a sample of it here, is it was quite popular to write things on beadwork, you know, like Alaska. And since a lot of the women at that time, that I'm talking about years ago, didn't read, they didn't know what it meant. And when you make a beadwork pattern, if you're making a pattern for slippers or moccasins or gloves or something that has two sets, you just reverse the pattern for the other side. And so you'll quite often see the writing reversed also. And because they didn't know how to read it, they didn't realize mm-hmm. that it was backwards. And that, if you see that, you can be pretty sure that it's probably an older piece, because most of the women do read nowadays.
Wow.
Wow.
Fantastic. Do you do this for people that just come in and ask questions? Is it mostly tourists that would come in here?
Actually, it's not mostly tourists. It's mostly Fort Yukon people, and we're kind of geared for Fort Yukon. Even the name of our museum, the Dingy Zhu and Jit Museum, means for the people of the Yukon Flats. But we do get quite a lot of tourists, and anybody who's interested, we talk to, if you notice in our museum, you'll see hardly any labels, and that's because we generally give an oral tour, and then we talk to the tourists, and one of the things we generally try to do is find out what their area of interest is, and then we'll emphasize that. For example, if we have a postman come in, we'll pull out a lot of things that aren't on exhibit that have to deal with the post office here. Or if there's an accountant that comes in, we don't have anything on accounting, but we do, tell them a little bit about the number system and things that we don't cover with just a, you know, anybody. It kind of depends on what the person is into that we, and how much time they have, because we can go on forever.
When the people from the area that live here come in, are they just looking to see mementos of the past, or are they learning something they've forgotten, or do they already know everything you've got to say?
We have a lot of programs that we do. We've been having these monthly get-togethers, and last month we did snowshoe webbing and small skin tanning. And people who have never done it and would like to try it come in and watch the demonstrations, and if they want, they can even participate in them. And we've done these on, a lot of things. We've done it on the Martin hat making, the canvas boot making, fish wheel building, fishnet making, just a lot of things like that. A lot of people come in to look at photographs. We have about 400 photographs. We also have a slideshow on the history of Fort Yukon that people come in and they'll want to see that, you know, several times. They rarely just see it once.
The list goes on, and I couldn't find a place to cut Ginny off. So next week we'll pick up from here and let Ginny Alexander of the Fort Yukon Museum tell us about Athabaskan games and baby diapers. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. And we're continuing a tour of the Fort Yukon Museum under the guidance of Ginny Alexander. Last week, we interrupted her as she was telling us about the community services the museum provides.
People come in for our art shows. We feature local artists whenever, about three or four times a year, we'll feature one or two local artists. People come in to bring in artifacts, things they found, or things that they would like the museum to preserve for them. We also do it once in a while, do a TV show, and we'll take one or two of the artifacts from here and take it over to the TV station and show it on the around town, just locally. And this way we can reach people who are shut in and can't get out to the museum. And then they also come in, and they call in and give us information on the artifacts and things like that. So we loan some of our items to the school. We loan quite a bit to the bilingual program. We also have our mammoth tusks, and some of our prehistoric bones are loaned to the fourth grade class now. We also give lectures on particular topics. We might, for example, child care in pre-contact times, or how to trace your roots, or almost whatever topic you know people are interested in. So we've got a bunch of different educational programs we try to gear them to all levels so that we don't hit just school kids or just adults. We try to make it for everybody. We also have a learning kit that we put together. That's what these games are for here. They go together in a kit, and this was I worked with some of the sixth grade bilingual students and then with some of the high school bilingual students, and we put together, went around town and interviewed the older people about games that people used to play here, and then they read all they could find about the games that people played. And then we went up to Arctic Village and interviewed the people up there because they remember a lot of these things better than the people here. And then we came back and made the games and put together a booklet to go with it.
What kind of game? Show me what you have.
Well, this game here is what we call a little stick game, and it's made up of, you have to have at least enough of these little skinny sticks. They're about like a chopstick size. And you have to have at least enough for one for everybody, but you can play with up to 40 sticks, and this is kind of noisy. So what you do is you put them on the palm of your hand, and you throw them up in the air and try to catch as many as you can on the back of your hand, and then you throw those up in the air and try to grab an odd number. So it's like this. I didn't catch any. Oh, I got one. So then I throw it up, and I try to catch an odd number. And since I caught an odd number, I would get to go again.
Uh-huh.
And that's how that game is played. Kind of. The beginning of the game is too complicated to explain. You have to be a professional in the game to get started. The beginning is the hardest part. This game here is a lot of fun. That ball there is made out of willow, six strips of willow that are tied together into a globe shape. And is what the kids do is they throw the ball into the river or creek. And then each one of the kids has a stick like this. It's just a willow branch with a bunch of the branches cut off, but leaving little points on it.
So there's lots of little forks on the stick.
Right.
And they run, and this kind of open-shaped ball.
And what they do is this stick here is attached to a long string. As you can see, I just got it tangled up. But each kid has a stick like this with a long string attached, and then the object is to run along the shore of the bank and spear the ball, catch it on one of the points, and pull it back to shore, which, of course, gives them what they need to know in order to run and hit a moving target and with a spear. And that was another part of the kit, was we showed how all of these games develop certain skills or muscles that a person would need in order to survive in adult time. This little stick game I showed you, that's the motion they use in webbing snowshoes and in netting the fish nets.
Oh, just the flipping of your wrist, what they call the old secret, the twist of the wrist.
Yeah. Then we have this game. This is just a plain old stick about, 8 inches long, and is all it's for is it's a tug-of-war game. And the Gwich'in had a lot of tug-of-war games, and this is one of them. And the object is just for one person to grab the other side and try to pull the stick away or pull the person mm-hmm. over to their side. And in fact, they say that one old man here in Fort Yukon, they used to play this game, and he got hold of that stick, and he wouldn't let go, and people could challenge him anytime they wanted to, and he held onto that stick for over a year before somebody pulled it away from him. This game is really fun. I really like this one. Each one of the kids is given a pointed stick about a foot long. And is what they do is, it's called, we call it the broad jump hop game, because that's what you do. You hop forward on 2 feet, and then you pick up 1 foot, and you hop forward on that foot. And then you have to hop forward one more time, and then you reach as far forward as you can and stick the stick in the ground. And again, it teaches the kids how to jump, like if they're crossing the river at breakup time or freeze-up time, or if they're getting on and off a moving toboggan or whatever, you know, this is a skill that they would need. This is a sling, as much as David and Goliath used in the old days, and the little hole here is for, that's where the rock, to hold the rock kind of in place.
Okay, so it's just an oval of leather with a hole in it and strings attached.
Yeah, and it's they swing it over their head, and then they let go of one side, and then the rock is like a projectile. It flies forward, and they say that the longer the string, the farther it will fly. Excuse me for a minute.
I hear the phone ringing, yes.
They actually used to use slings in killing animals, or stunning them anyway, so that you could go up and then bang them over the head and kill them. One thing I forgot to mention on that hoop game, instead of a stick sometimes, is what they would do is tie a piece of rock in a piece of caribou, a little rock in a caribou hide, and tie it on the end of a string, and then they would throw that out, and it would wrap around, and then they could pull that willow ball back to shore. But that's also a method for they used in pulling ducks out of the water when they went duck hunting. And then we have this game, beaver hip bone game, is considered, this is one of the universal games. Every society has a game like it, and this is all it is a stick about 12 inches long with a string with a beaver bone attached, hip bone. This is the beaver hip bone attached to it. And they say that the men used to play this. The women didn't have time for games. They were busy working. But anyway, the men would sit around in a circle, and evidently this was after the time of the, at least, I doubt it was more than 200 years ago. But anyways, what they would do is one fellow would take out his pipe and light up and start smoking. And then give this to the fellow sitting on his left, and the object is just to swing it up and catch it through the hole in the beaver hip bone. And as long as that fellow was trying it, the guy with the pipe got a smoke. And when the fellow made it, then he got the pipe, and the game would be passed to the next person. So if you like to smoke, you sit next to somebody who's not too coordinated. And this is a bead puzzle, a knot puzzle. Since everything used to be tied down and bound on and whatnot, the people were very good with knots and knot puzzles. And this is one that we made. And once you know how to do it, it's real easy. But trying to figure it out, it's very, very difficult. And in this booklet that we put together, we have 12 games in the kit, and then we list about 32 other. We list 32 games altogether. Some of the games, the equipment for some of the games was too big to put into a small traveling kit. We have a moose hide ball over there. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
That's for baseball. And it the way that Gwichin used to play baseball, it's just really a lot of fun. There's two people on a team, and the pitcher and the batter are on the same team. So the pitcher throws the ball to the batter, and the batter hits it with any kind of stick. And then the two guys on the other team go and get the ball. Meanwhile, the pitcher and the batter grab each other's hands and swing each other around as fast as they can. And the two guys on the other team get the ball, and the object is to throw the ball and hit the batter. And it's kind of like, it turns into like dodgeball. And so it's really a wild game, but it's a lot of fun.
Great. What have we got here?
These are moss diapers.
That's what I thought they might be.
I wish I'd known about these a long time ago, believe me. This one is made out of moose hide, and it's got a little hole here in the center where the women stuff in moss. And the women gather a lot of really, or in the old days, they used to gather a lot of this really, really soft moss. And then that's what the baby went on, and when it got dirty or soiled or whatever, they would dispose of that and put in fresh moss. This one next to it is made out of an old flour sack, and I think this one was actually used. This other one was just made because someone was telling me about it. But I think this one was used. It's made from an old flour sack, I think, and then it's got caribou fringe on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's got the soft moss here, and it has four ties on either side. So it's got it ties all
security.
Together. Yeah, security. But that's what they used to put on the children. They also have a birch bark baby carrier. It's in another room, but is what they would do is put either moths or else a bird's nest on there, and they would set the baby on that and let him do his thing in there.
That's one way of putting it. Over in another part of the Fort Yukon Museum, there are a scattering of fossils and bones and an array of furs and hides. That's where we go next.
This is a mammoth tusk. Now, our other one is on loan. And these are found along the riverbank. As the bank caves in, these are exposed, and then whoever finds it can keep it. It's theirs. And it used to be that way. Now the government wants it. But fortunately, we had ours before the government changed the law. These are the bison horn, the prehistoric bison. They stood about 10 feet at the shoulder, which is considerably larger than today's. And we have a couple of those. This piece here is the only piece we've had carbon dated, and it's part of the pelvic bone of some prehistoric animal. They're not sure, they're not positive which one, but it's carbon dated at 14,000 years. And this was just found on the riverbank. Somebody just picked it up. And we have a fossilized snail that's also out on loan. Then over here we have some of the modern day animals, and I'm sorry about the lighting, but I took that down. Anyway, first one is a wolverine which is especially good for roughs on parkas because it doesn't freeze up like some animals do. Then we have the rabbit. You'll notice our signs are in English and Gwich'in. Gwich'in is the name of the language here and also the name of the people. And so anyway, we have the rabbit. In the old days, the people used to take the rabbit skin and cut it spirally. And then when it dried, it would twist. And then they would interweave these into blankets for children, especially for babies, because they weren't very heavy. And then we have the moose hair, moose hide. And the moose hair was used for a lot of things. They used to twist it and sew it on clothing as decoration. It's also used as bedding for dogs. They still do that. And it's the moose hide ball you saw over there is stuffed with moose hair. We tried stuffing it with other things, but it didn't work. It's rather resilient or something, I don't know.
For dog bedding, then, they just scrape the hair off and throw it into the doghouse or something?
Yeah. You know, instead of using grass or straw. Moose hair is warmer. This is a part of a moose stomach. The whole stomach is quite large, and actually moose has four stomachs. But this is part of the large one, and is what they used to use this for is the people would dig a hole in the ground, and then they would set this in there. Sometimes it would be on a willow frame. And then they would fill it up with water and their meat and put hot rocks in there to cook their meat. That's the way they used to cook. And they'd say 3 rocks for medium, 4 rocks for well done. Because it's kind of interesting to watch people butcher moose because they have such interesting names for it. There's one stomach in there that's quite small, but it's real thick, and it's got a whole bunch of folds, and they call that the Bible because it looks like a little Bible. And then they have the fat around the moose's lungs is called a Vatsagitsuk's necklace. Vatsagitsuk is a local folk hero, kind of, and so they call that his necklace. But it's kind of, they've got some very interesting names. I think it's interesting to watch them butcher a moose. Then we have the black bears, and black bears are real common in this area. They had a lot of trouble with them this summer at fish camps, you know, bothering the fish and bothering people. In fact, they shot one down by our house about 300 yards from our house this summer.
What was the Gwich'in name for black bear there?
Shoshray. Then we have the weasel, or ermine, as it should be called in its winter colors. And the ermine tail used to be considered lucky. And if you look at old photographs and sketches of people's clothing in the old days, you'll quite often see it sewn on there to bring luck to the person who was wearing it. And then we have the reason why the white man came up here, for the pelts. And the muskrat and the beaver pelts from the Yukon Flats area are extremely valuable due to the fact of the ecology of the region. They have a very high nutritious diet, and then we get the extremely cold temperatures where it hits 70 below. So they grow these especially thick pelts. And excuse me again.
This time the telephone call took a while, and so we stop here in our visit to the Fort Yukon Museum with Ginny Alexander. There's still much more to learn about the history and people of the Yukon Flats on next week's Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.